Welcome to All Sides with Anna Stever. For the last several years, Attorney General Dave Yost has held a sex trafficking summit in Columbus, bringing together survivors, advocates, and law enforcement to share knowledge and collaborate on solutions. The goal has been simple: identify gaps in state efforts to end forced prostitution and labor. But achieving it hasn't been easy. Ohio still ranks among the top 10 states for the number of calls made to the National Human Trafficking Hotline, and in 2022, we were fifth in the nation for trafficking. We're spending the next hour learning how Ohio is fighting back, what still needs to be done, and what myths persist about the ways people find themselves forced into these situations. We begin with Attorney General Dave Yost. Welcome to All Sides.
It's good to be with you, Anna.
I want to begin our conversation with Ohio's geography and infrastructure. What is it about our interstates and our turnpikes that appeal to human traffickers?
Well, people sometimes talk about Ohio as being the crossroads of America. We've got major interstates going north and south and east and west with I-80, I-70. About two-thirds of the population of America is within a single-day drive of Ohio. That combined with our ports on the lake and the river make it a place where people come through a lot for all kinds of things, including human trafficking.
When did you first become aware of the problem here in Ohio?
So this is kind of a fun story. I used to be the prosecutor in Delaware County, and I was one of the leaders.
Great
in this
county, not just because I live there.
I won't argue with you. The State Prosecuting Attorneys Association, I was on the board and one of the leaders. And so some people, this is in the early 2000s, maybe 2006, 2007, came to us, and I was asked to take some meetings to talk about this problem. And I said, well, we've already got compelling prostitution. We've got laws on the books already. Thank you very much. We're good. I look at the back of that with some embarrassment because that was the kind of the bleeding edge of the movement, and I missed that moment. Later on, I became friends with people like Judge Herbert in the Franklin County Catch Court and started seeing and learning more about what people in the movement called the life, and realized that our existing laws were nowhere near adequate, that this was a much bigger problem than people thought it was, and that we needed a dramatically different approach.
And this is also an issue raised by your predecessor, now Governor Mike DeWine, when he was Attorney General.
Yes. And we had a foundation when we came in. We had a human trafficking commission within the office. We took that a lot farther. We established additional organized crime task forces across the state with our local law enforcement partners and our social service providers. We expanded the social service element to what the task forces were doing dramatically. We lobbied for changes in the law, and I'm very proud of some of the things that we've done. And we started the Human Trafficking Summit 5 years ago. This was the fifth one. We had 750 people from all over the state that attended, and as well as some other places in the country.
So what is the purpose of these annual summits?
So at the front end, it's, you know, any other kind of conference, right? We're gonna learn about the latest research. We're gonna talk about best practices. Equally importantly, it's networking. But in this case, it's maybe the most important thing is the continuity of the movement, the encouragement, the affirmation. Many of these folks are working in the darkest parts of society. Places where despair is common and hope is rare. Many of them have limited support networks of people. I mean, if you don't work in this area, you don't get what's going on. You don't understand the secondary trauma of seeing these broken lives and the evil that's out there up close and personal. The summit allows all of these heroes, all of these frontline people to come together and encourage each other to understand that they're not alone in this fight. And I think it's a hugely important psychological moment for the people that are doing this hard, underpaid, and underappreciated work.
I want to talk a little bit about what human trafficking looks like, because there's two main kinds. There's forced labor and forced prostitution. And you've launched guides for communities to help fight human trafficking, to basically make them aware of what it looks like. So I want to talk a little bit about what that looks like, because I think there's a lot of myths out there about how people fall into human trafficking in particular. This idea, I'm a mom of young girls, and there's always those scare stories about Someone followed me at Target. They were trying to snatch my children for human trafficking. That's incredibly rare.
Yeah, that's really not what happens. I'm not going to say that there's no such instances. But the vast majority of these, the people that are brought into human trafficking are kind of seduced into it. The traffickers look for people who have a broken heart, who are isolated, who have childhood trauma, who maybe feel like they don't fit in.
Have an unstable home life
or a difficult relationship with their parents or don't have parents at home. They will show love to these people. They will buy them clothes. They'll buy them food. They'll give them a ride after school. They will make these people believe that they're the only ones in the world that care for them. And frequently, if you talk to a survivor after the fact, they're still loyal to their trafficker because the trafficker is the only one that they feel like ever really cared for them, even while they were exploiting them for profit.
So it's Stockholm syndrome in a way.
We don't call it that anymore, but there is an affinity that occurs secondary to trauma.
And that leads me to a clip I want to play. It's from 2020 training session with the Columbus Police Department recruits. And a woman named Vanessa Perkins, a sex trafficking survivor, spoke about how she ended up in that situation.
It doesn't just happen overnight. It's not like I woke up one day and poof, I was trafficked. It actually started when I was four. When I was 4 years old and this man was creeping into my bedroom and he was doing horrible things to me. And I literally just hated everything. Like I was just dark inside.
Do you hear that sort of story a lot of childhood abuse and childhood trauma in women who end up sex trafficked?
It is unfortunately common. Now, it's not necessarily the trafficker who started it, but it is that violation of basic humanity and the innocence of childhood that trauma sets you on a trajectory where in later years you're vulnerable to recruitment, what we call grooming.
And it's less likely to happen suddenly in a Target, and it's more likely to happen online.
They're not lurking in the bushes. The predators are lurking in your child's phone.
Yeah. I mean, we did a story, or we covered the story a couple months ago, about the number of pedophiles who search on Instagram for pictures of young children to share with each other.
Mm. And we see this across platforms. We're involved with some stuff on Facebook right now where people are putting up pictures of their kids in swimsuits and this and that, trying to make money. And the algorithm on Facebook is connecting it with known pedophiles. And Facebook,
because that's what they're interested in, and the algorithm gives you what you like.
Yes, exactly. The online world is incredibly dangerous for children.
What about forced labor? Because I think we hear less about that, but it's no less pernicious. How does somebody end up in a forced labor situation here in Ohio?
Yeah, we had at the Human Trafficking Summit a guy named Harold D'Souza, a great example. He came to this country from India. The people who brought him here are promising to, you know, help him reestablish, build a new life in America, ended up forcing him to work. They took his identification. They didn't pay him. He and his family were forced to sleep on the floor of a bare apartment, and they had to work 7 days a week. And if they ever objected that they weren't getting paid or they weren't working on being able to, you know, work toward their freedom, they were told that, you know, they would turn them in to the immigration authorities and they'd be deported. Now, they eventually escaped, thank God, but it took they were in indentured servitude for 2 years. We see this happening, not everywhere, but it happens in manufacturing. It happens in agriculture. And one of our initiatives this year is to expand the work we're doing in sex trafficking to labor trafficking as well.
In July, you launched the latest video for emergency workers, alerting them to the types of injuries consistent with trafficking victims. But I think hesitancy, maybe even distrust towards law enforcement, is a particular problem when it comes to people who have been sex trafficked. And I want to play some audio. It's from 6 years ago, from a survivor talking about her experience.
I was in this hotel for like 2 years straight. I mean, like, they would bring you your food, they would give you your drinks, they would give you your drugs. You got to sleep with who they tell you to.
You pray and wish that you could be done with this lifestyle.
When we would sit there and talk about, hey, you know, how are we gonna get out of this? Well, you can call the police. Well, you gotta think, we're doing dates with police officers, with detectives, we're doing dates with them. I never felt safe. I never thought I could turn to them for nothing.
I've had the real type of law supposed to help you and then the type of law that's used you. So it was hard to trust them. You know, an officer rolls up on you, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if he's going to force you to do something or if he's there to actually help you.
It's really traumatic. Like, it's horrible. I wouldn't wish that lifestyle on nobody.
You know, it's kind of a jolt to hear women say that officers were part of the problem. And that was 6 years ago. How are you working to change that and to make women feel more comfortable coming forward?
Yeah, great question, because, you know, we've had, you know, on the extremes, people like Andrew Mitchell, a Columbus police officer, vice cop, who, you know, acted in a way that it was just
inappropriate.
Horrible.
Yeah.
Well,
beyond.
He was charged with killing Denise Castleberry.
Oh my gosh.
So those are the extremes. But we also had instances where the only time a survivor ever came into contact with a cop was when they were getting locked up. The approach has changed since that interview happened. And I'm not going to say that it's changed everywhere, but we've worked hard here in Ohio to recognize that a survivor is a victim of crime. And while there may be technical violations of the law and there may be a place for involvement of courts, the primary evil is being done by the trafficker, not by the survivor. And so when we come across a survivor in one of our enforcement operations, we have people that are there. Do you need a shower? Do you need a meal? Do you need drug treatment? We can get you a bed tonight. No waiting list. We'll take you there if you're addicted. We'll help you with your withdrawal sickness. And, you know, do you have kids? Can we help with the kids? So we're working hard to change the interaction. But, you know, some of these traumas run deep and memories run long. I've met women who have been in and out of the life over 25 years, still struggling with their trauma and the secondary addiction. There's a lot more work to do. My heart breaks when I hear testimonies like that survivor that you just played.
You've also worked on legislation here in Ohio, working on laws that would allow trafficking survivors to have certain offenses like prostitution expunged from their criminal records. I understand that passed the House and the Senate, and the governor is supposed to sign it soon, if I'm understanding that correct, right? Soon that will be the law of Ohio.
He did sign it since you were briefed, and it will become law on the 24th of October. We had an earlier version of this that was very hard to access and fairly narrow. This is a broader approach. It still doesn't include, you know, offenses, you know, a murder or terrorism, things like that. But the lower level kinds of crimes where a trafficker often forces the survivor into committing crimes, those we now have an option to allow them a new clean start, which means better access to housing, school, employment, all of those kinds of things.
You also recently launched a state hotline for sex traffickers. We have a national hotline. We've had that for nearly 20 years. Why did you want to create one here in Ohio?
Well, there's some problems with the national hotline, and I greatly appreciate our partners there at Polaris, and you know, their heart is in the right place. But that distrust of law enforcement has meant that there's information that comes into the hotline that never gets to law enforcement. That's just not where we need to be. In other cases, it gets there, but it shows up 2 months late. So the idea of an Ohio-specific hotline is something that is here, nimble, not weighted down with national concerns, and that's going to be cooperative with law enforcement. Again, our goal is not to arrest the survivors of human trafficking. Our goal is to find their traffickers. But law enforcement is a necessary ingredient to this.
In Ohio, trafficking a person is a first-degree felony with a mandatory minimum of 10 years in prison. Do you think the penalties should be harsher, or do you think that's at the right place right now?
You know, that's a tough question, because when we talk about comparative evil, this is as pernicious as killing somebody or a forcible rape, in my view. Now, I honestly think that there are predators out there that commit, you know, the worst of the worst kinds of crimes like this that maybe ought to be just taken off the streets to stay away from the rest of us longer. 10 years is probably enough in the sense of punishment. I'm not sure it's enough for the rest of us for public safety. I think there's crimes that you can commit against society that are so dramatic, a child rape, that you just don't deserve to be a free person anymore.
And the Ohio hotline for trafficking, if you want to call, is 1-844-363-6448. Again, it's 844-363-6448. Final question. Where do you want this summit on sex trafficking, or what do you hope to accomplish before you leave office? You got 2 years left as Attorney General. Maybe you'll do something else after that, but where do you see it going? What's the legacy you want to leave behind?
Well, we still have a list of things to work on. We've got some legal changes we are, you know, trying to refine. But here's the big thing, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this for a second. Julia Roberts and Richard Gere is not real. They are not free-spirited, lucky, you know, happy-go-lucky people out there selling themselves who find true love and a rich dude and live happily ever after. We're focused on trying to reduce the demand side. My repetitive thing is don't buy sex in Ohio. Here's why. If you're a guy and you're buying sex, you have no idea whether the person that you're buying it from who is saying, sure, I'll do that for this amount of money, is doing that because they've chosen to or if there's somebody else in the next room that has the heroin fix that they don't get if they don't follow through, or they've got a knife or a baseball bat and they're going to hurt them. If you buy sex without knowing that, and you can't know, you're accepting the risk that you are complicit in human trafficking. Don't buy sex in Ohio.
That was Attorney General Dave Yost. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up, how Franklin County's Catch Court is helping women regain their lives. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. More than 1,200 women are arrested for solicitation each year in Franklin County. But the statistic doesn't tell the whole story. The women, and it's mostly women, come to the criminal justice system with complicated histories and stories that include abuse and addiction. But above all, trauma. In 2009, Franklin County Municipal Judge Paul Herbert created a special court to help survivors of prostitution and sex trafficking. It's called Catch Court, and the name stands for Creating Autonomy Through Collaborative Healing. Gwen England serves as the program leader for Catch Court, and she joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Glenn.
Gwen. Thanks. It's great to be here.
Also joining us is a 2019 Catch Court graduate, Melissa Stacey. She's now the housing director and clinical substance abuse counselor for Another Chance Ministries. Welcome to All Sides.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Melissa, I want to play audio of you in 2019 from your Catch Court graduation.
Catch Court saved my life. I didn't have a light until they shined theirs on me so I could find mine. When I first got into Catch Court, I seen a judge, I seen a bailiff, I seen a PO. And I seen people that worked in the court system. I felt, I'm not trusting you guys. You guys don't want to help me and you guys don't believe in me. But they didn't give up on me. Even when I didn't understand it and I questioned their motives, they didn't ever give up on me. They seen in me what I could never see. They spoke life into me. They taught me how to love myself. When I didn't want to show up, they cared me. You know, when you walk in the Catch Court, it says the no shame zone. But I switch it up and call it the safe zone because when I walk into that courtroom, I feel safe. I don't have to be that hard, rough exterior girl that I had to be on the streets. I could let all those walls down and just be me, and it was okay. And when I could be me in there, I learned to become me outside of there.
Oh, I don't even know what to say. I mean, that was you 5 years ago.
Yeah.
It's got to be crazy to look back on then versus now.
Absolutely. It's very emotional to hear.
Yeah, I'm a sympathetic crier, so I'm trying very hard not to tear up. But Gwen, it has to be. I mean, are these the stories? Is this every day for you?
Yeah, and so much more, right? Like, Melissa, I think, is an extraordinary success story. Unfortunately, that's not every story that comes into Catch, but she's special.
Yeah, the profile of Catch Court participants show women facing multiple challenges. 72% grow up in poverty. 86% don't have a high school diploma or GED. 93% are mothers. Mm-hmm. 83% have been in the mental health system. Mm-hmm. and 94% have been victims of sexual or intimate partner abuse. Mm-hmm. Those are hard histories.
Yeah, it's significant. So when women come into our program, we administer an assessment to gauge what their needs are and what their diagnoses are. One of the parts of that assessment is something called the ACE questionnaire, which
I've heard of this.
For, yes, adverse childhood experiences. So essentially the research indicates that if you have 4 or above on that questionnaire, it's a 10-point scale, that you're kind of out of luck for having a easy life or an easy road ahead of you. The probability that you are going to end up with involvement in the criminal legal system skyrockets. The risk for mental health and substance use skyrockets. And of the women we have in Catch Core right now, the average score is 7. So that kind of speaks to the very difficult histories that they have just in childhood alone, let alone once they've reached adulthood, even prior to their trafficking experience. They have a lot of barriers and a lot of trauma.
Melissa, we played a video clip from earlier, from 6 years ago, and it was a woman saying that she was reluctant to call the police because she didn't think police were always there to help. Did you feel that way when you first came into contact with Catch Court?
Oh, absolutely. Not even just police, but for me, it was anybody who worked in a court system, whether it was probation officer, bailiff, judge, the security guards that where you go through the security detector. They were all the same to me. But it didn't just start when I was in the life. Mine started at a very young age with my first experience with my mother passed away. So yeah, absolutely.
Can I ask how she passed?
She committed suicide.
Oh my goodness.
And I found her dead getting ready for school.
Oh my gosh. That has to be so incredibly difficult.
Very much so. And from what I can remember, I understand, like, you know, they have a job to do. But as far as, like, the detectives and just that whole morning, it just was very non-compassionate as to what had happened from what I can remember. And so from there on, you know, cops weren't something that was, like, warming for me.
You spoke at the first sex trafficking summit here in Ohio.
Yes.
5 years ago. How would you say our state has changed in the terms of the way it handles forced prostitution and forced labor?
I think that there's a lot more awareness and conversation that is happening along with trainings and education. I think the women are somewhat more heard today, and it's not so much as, you know, the stigma of they chose this life. This is the life that they wanted for themselves. I think that there is still work that can be done. Mm-hmm. But I also think that there's more resources as far as help and what to do after, because that's a huge issue. Mm-hmm. You know, you get out of the life, you get off the streets, and then what? You know, you don't have a house, you don't have education, you don't have financial stability, you don't have support. And so you put yourself in this hole mm-hmm. that is so hard to get out of. And then you have a distrust for people that they actually want to help you. And so I think that that has what has changed. There's an after, you know.
Gwen, how is Catch Court working on that after?
Well, Catch hopes to provide a 2-year space for them to be able to get the resources that Melissa's talking about that they need to be able to rebuild their lives. I think an essential part of that, outside of like the tangible things, right? Like a place to stay, their basic needs being met, access to education or workforce development. I think the really special thing about Catch that sets us apart from other specialized dockets who are doing similar work with different populations is the community that we have built in Central Ohio for the women who are exiting the life. The courtroom Melissa referenced in her graduation speech is called the No Shame Zone. This population has experienced so much stigma on so many levels because it comes with the sex industry, it comes with mental health, it comes with addiction, it comes with motherhood and not having custody of your children, right? Like every corner of these women's lives, they are experiencing stigma and judgment and shame and guilt. And they can come into this community and be loved until they learn to love themselves, and they can be accepted and find a sense of belonging. And that safety and belonging is the first step in healing. explained trauma. So without that, how far can we actually go? So I think that is one of the most important ingredients that Catch Court has to offer.
Not to use a cliche, but it sounds like the you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know lots of survivors that are afforded resources after they exit. But I truly think the ones that are able to move past surviving into like the space of thriving, the space of where they find joy in waking up, and they have family and they have community, it's the ones that are able to foster that support network and embrace their authentic selves and not feel shame for that.
Melissa, can you tell us a little bit about Another Chance Ministry down in Chillicothe?
Yeah, so we're a faith-based organization that offers mental health services, substance abuse services for people from all different types of backgrounds and lifestyles, whether it's incarceration, whether they're coming right off the street, whether they've already completed an inpatient service. Our visionary, Pastor J. Troy Gray, he birthed it out of his own lived experience with his son that was in addiction, and he believed if I can make it happen for someone else, then maybe it can happen for him. And so we are ORH accredited with housing. We do clinical services through Full Circle, very family dynamic in aspect. We believe in community service. Of course, we believe in Christ and, you know, just not being freed from the life, but just being freed overall and freed in general. And right now we have about 80 clients. We have 19 houses, anywhere from, we have three levels of care. We offer sober living houses, but we even go as far, you know, for a pastor, it's like you talk about the barriers, even for the women, you know, that's not for just that case, but for anyone who has suffered with mental health, substance abuse, they get to that point, but it's like the landlord won't rent to them. Mm-hmm. This person won't give a job. And mm-hmm. so we try to fit all those needs. So we even have some houses where families live in and pastor rents it out to them, you know, just to try to get them to that next step. So, yeah.
How did you first get involved with them?
So for me, it was very important to get out of Columbus. I had no good memories here. My sister lives here. It was important that for me, I do a geographical change and an internal change. And so I went down and I was at the Recovery Council. And back then, Another Chance didn't have a women's program, which there's a funny story about that. But I have tried everything, but I never tried the God component. And so for me, the experience that I had as a child, I always believed in God, but I'm like, if these things happen, you know, why serve him? And so I grew a hunger, and the Recovery Council, like, you know, they don't really take you to church and different stuff like that. And so I kind of just forced my way into Zion Baptist Church, and I created a home there, and I created a community. Mm-hmm. It's very emotional for me. And so they had the men's side and they just had a few houses, and I would go to Pastor and I would go to Rochelle Gray Buchanan, who was my mentor at the time. She's now my best friend and my boss. And I would say, when are you going to open a women's program? When are you going to open a women's program? Because I was determined that I wanted to give back and I wanted to help, but I didn't want to tiptoe around how I got clean, which is God, you know? And so that happened finally, because at first they're like, no, we're not doing a women's program. We're going to stick small, stay small. And they did. And
you talked them into it.
Yes. Because I knew that that was my assignment. Also, my husband went through the ministry. Timothy Stacy, he's an associate minister of Zion Baptist Church. And so that changed his life. And although I didn't go through the program of ACM, I still reaped the benefits of ACM, being able to build my career there and mm-hmm. still being supported, still finding that path of my identity in Christ and what that looked like, and building mm-hmm. a family.
You yeah, know? You have two little kids now.
Yeah, Jesselyn and Paisley. They are my life. They are miracle babies. I was told for a really long time that I wouldn't have kids. I never got pregnant or had miscarriages. And so I always just kind of believed that that would never be something that I would get to experience. And it happened for me. So I birthed both of them in 2021.
They're not twins, though.
No. Woo-wee.
So you were pregnant for like 2 years straight.
Three. Yeah. Three. We lost our first baby right after our honeymoon. And for me, that was God revealing that you're not broken and you are still worthy to carry a child. And then Jesslyn came, and then Paisley came right after. And they bring so much life to me and my husband. Jesslyn's actually going to have her first cheerleading game on Saturday. Aww. So just like I live a life that the world said I couldn't. Mm-hmm. I live a life that people said I could never have, that I would never make it, and I would never get out the life, and I did.
Mm-hmm. That's Melissa Stacy, a Catch Court graduate and a minister with Another Chance Ministry. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation on human trafficking and how we can end it. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded Podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about human trafficking and how Ohio is working to end it. Still with us is Gwen England, program leader for Franklin County's Catch Court, and Melissa Stacy, a 2019 Catch Court graduate who is the housing director and clinical substance abuse counselor for Another Chance Ministries in Chillicothe. Finding a way forward can be difficult. Gwen, there are barriers to finding employment and criminal records, childcare needs, mental health issues. I want to ask you about programs like Freedom a la Carte and Sanctuary Night and how you partner with them.
Yeah, absolutely. So those are two of my favorite organizations. So Freedom a la Carte has been around for much longer than Sanctuary Night. So I'm assuming that several of the listeners are going to be familiar with them. They are a nonprofit catering company that provides lots of supportive services to Catch Court participants, and they also facilitate our aftercare program for the court. So what that looks like is we have lunch every Thursday in between our Catch Court sessions that are provided by volunteers at Freedom. They bring in lunch so that the women can eat and build community amongst each other. They offer a mentorship program for the women. So if they want a mentor, they will establish a relationship with somebody to journey with them for 2 years and support them through their recovery. And a lot of those mentors are still very close with their Catch participants, even after graduation. They also run a workforce development program that the women in our Catch docket have an opportunity to participate in, which will give them the essential skills to be able to be successful in the workforce. A lot of these women have not held legal employment for sometimes over a decade, don't have a checking account, don't know how to clock in and out, all those sorts of things. So it really equips them for, you know, life after Catch to be able to make a livable wage and sustain their families. But they also offer outings once a month, which is really kind of a fun experience because many of the women in our program have never been to the zoo. They've never had.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. They've never had like a Thanksgiving dinner. So every month, the last Thursday of the month, we will have a outing that is organized and supported by Freedom. And sometimes it's like bowling. We just go to the bowling alley and eat pizza. But especially during the holiday season, like October, November, December, it's kind of like my favorite because we have a holiday party for Halloween and everybody dresses up and wears a costume and we play goofy games and it's a riot. It's a lot of fun. And then Thanksgiving dinner. And then in December, we have sort of a holiday with Christmas trees and carols, and they get gift bags and such. So just the amount of resources that are available to the women in Ketch through the supportive services at Freedom is profound. We could not do what we do without Freedom a la Carte supporting our work. And the women, I don't think, would be nearly as prepared after graduation if it were not for Freedom and all that they do to help set them up for success. As far as Sanctuary Night goes, Sanctuary Night is, you know, a newer organization. So viewers or listeners might not be quite as familiar, but I believe Hannah Estabrook was on the program a couple months back.
She was.
So she probably gave you a good rundown, but they offer harm reduction services to the women who are on the streets of Sullivan Avenue. So high majority of the cases that come into Ketch Court come from the west side of Columbus. Sullivan Avenue is kind of the known strip for individuals who are in the sex industry. There's lots of homelessness, lots of people battling with substance use issues, and they will just offer life-saving services to be able to keep them around until, you know, they decide maybe they want to make a different choice in their life. And if they don't, that's okay. But they're present with these individuals, the women, and are able to provide everything from a shower to Narcan, medical services, food, a nap, just a place to breathe and be safe and not have to think about staying safe for the next 5 minutes while they're out on the streets. And this is important, particularly for Ketch Court, because we have recently shifted our operational philosophy on how we handle the cases that come into Ketch. When we first started, human trafficking didn't even have a law in Ohio. We had no idea what we were doing, and we were just doing the best that we could with what we knew. And I think the more that we learn and the more that we listen to the women and the more that best practices are established, we understand the importance of autonomy and giving them a chance to feel empowered in their own life and in their recovery and deciding what that looks like for them and what they need, and not us basically telling them, this is what your life is going to look like for 2 years, because that's how it was before. And that was with the intent of safety. We were trying to keep them in a space where they were away from harm. But what we found out was that, like, the rules weren't actually keeping them safe. It was just causing them to keep secrets. So when we said, you can't talk to these people because they've caused you harm, maybe it was their trafficker or an abusive boyfriend or a mother who's in addiction or whatever, they would just sneak around and do it anyways and not tell us. And so I think what was happening was there was a lack of trust. There was a fear-based system where they didn't feel like they could be honest. And also after graduation, they had no ability to make choices for themselves without the lens of the criminal legal system and punishment. So if I'm not going to do something only because I'll get in trouble for it on probation, then when you graduate and you're not on probation and somebody says, hey, do you want to go smoke crack? And you have no idea how to decide, is this a thing I should do or a thing I shouldn't do? And all you think about is like, will I get in trouble for probation? But probation's no longer there. It's like, well, I don't have a reason not to, right? So we tried to reframe this muscle of making decisions to what is good for your life, your goals, your recovery. That's how you make choices. Is this going to get me closer to where I want to be in life and what the goals are that I set out for myself? But anybody that has worked in this population knows that that's the long game, and it takes a while to get there. So in the short term, when they don't have those skills to make good choices yet, and they're learning that, they make a lot of bad choices. And so we cannot have this sort of like empowering autonomous approach without also coupling it with partnerships in the community that offer safe space and harm reduction if they end up making a bad choice. So Sanctuary Night is the safe place where if a Ketch woman relapses and ends up back on the street, she can go to Sanctuary Night. And she has community there. She has familiar faces there. Their staff is primarily Ketch Court graduates that have been out of the life for years. And so there's like inherent hope that is present when they go in that space that they can do something different and get back on track. But also they will get them back into detox and then let us know. So if in the meantime a warrant was issued for a woman, but she's been going to Sanctuary Night and getting her needs met and staying alive. And then she decides, I want to not look over my shoulder anymore. I want to get my warrant taken care of. Can I get into detox? Sanctuary Night staff will reach out to us. We will get the warrant set aside and then re-engage her in the docket. So we've just seen a lot of success in this continuity of care and the recognition that, as Melissa stated, the legal system is scary. And they're not going to, like, come in and talk to us when they have a active warrant because they're afraid they're going to be arrested. And so Sanctuary Night is really the arm that is able to reach out to them, get them to safety, and then facilitate getting them back in good standing with the court so they don't have to try to navigate that.
You know, I love that you described it as a muscle that needs rebuilding. Mm-hmm. Because I think sometimes it's really easy to look at a situation and be like, how are you making these choices?
That's right.
And Melissa, I want to ask you about that because you were featured in a 2020 BBC documentary, and one of the women said, I didn't know how to do life very well. Mm-hmm. And I sort of wonder, how does trauma and the way what led up to you being out on the streets, how does that get in the way of this muscle or this ability to make choices?
I mean, I think it can go back to distrust. There's always, you know, for women like us, when we're in the streets, there's always a motive, you know, for whomever we encounter. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that even goes as far as everybody you look at, there's a motive.
Everything's transactional.
Mm-hmm. Everything. And then your vision is really blurred because, you know, you see in the movies or when people who have are not educated or don't have lived experiences, when they speak about it, they have this idea of what it looks like. But for me, my vision was blurred because I did dates with doctors, nurses, construction workers, probation officers, police officers. And so when you are trapped in a world like that, even the world outside of that can be something like a prison because you don't know who you can trust. Are you really trying to help me or are you setting me up? Is there a motive? What are you gaining from this? So, yeah.
What would you say to somebody in that situation now? What would you want them to know, given where you are today?
I would want them to know that it's okay. That they have a better chance of taking a chance with a place like that than they do in the other situations that they place themselves in. Mm-hmm. I myself didn't, you know, Sanctuary Night wasn't there when I was in the streets. But without saying any names, I mean, I have a woman now that went through our program, that graduated, that is thriving, mm-hmm. Just got her license, got a car. She's freed from a lot of the trauma and the pain that kept her trapped into that. And it started at Sanctuary Night for her. Mm-hmm. And so it's amazing how all of these things end up always coming together, mm-hmm. you know. With Sanctuary Night, there was a drop-in center for me when I was in the life, and that I can remember getting simple things like clothing and food, and I would never stay too long because in my mind it's like, you stay too long, what if somebody shows up, what if they called the cops on me? Mm-hmm. But I stayed long enough to receive just a little bit of love, to have like a little bit of a good experience. And so if you are out there right now, and for whatever reason you may be listening, I would say take that chance. Go through that door.
So what's next, I guess? Where do you think Gwen, Ohio goes next? Where does Catch Court go next?
Mm-hmm. That's a big question.
It is, and we have like 2 minutes left to answer it.
Okay, that's good to know. So I will be quick. So one of the things that I kind of get on a soapbox about when it comes to this idea of ending human trafficking, it feels to me that we are entirely too reactionary. And I want to imagine a world in which we are being proactive about decreasing vulnerabilities in people's lives so that they don't get exploited. There is no trafficking without vulnerabilities. So when we think about addressing those vulnerabilities, it's everything that we said in the beginning. It's poverty. It's, you know, lack of education. It's broken families and unstable homes and homelessness and mental health and addiction that runs in the family and goes untreated. Every large system in our society is struggling to fix these vulnerabilities. And I think we just need to take a hard look at that and do a better job.
That was Gwen England, program leader for Franklin County's Catch Court. Thank you for your time today.
Mm-hmm.
And Melissa, you had a number you wanted to share with us before the end of the hour?
Yeah, so if you are someone who is out there struggling with mental health or substance abuse, and you would like to try a faith-based component, or maybe you have a family member who is struggling with addiction or trauma or incarceration, I would like to extend this number for our intake for Another Chance Ministries. It is 740-573-7005, extension 102. Reach out. There's no better time than now.
That was Melissa Stacy from Another Chance Ministries. Thank you for your time this morning. And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.